I mean, I didn't have an ex. I had a one very close friend who was Sagittarius, and I think we got along. I mean, we told ourselves, well, we're friends because Sagittarius and Gemini get along. Like, whatever.
I guess the people in my life who have actually done harm to me in some of the most profoundly fucked up ways are all Sagittarians.
All Sagittarius? Oh,
All.
shit.
I don't mean
Yeah,
some, I mean all of them,
better
like
clear then.
every last fucking one of them. I met Mary Higgins Clark once, and her daughter, it's a Carol Higgins Clark. Their mother daughter, like they're mystery writers. They write like those mystery
Right.
stories. So she said one of them, I don't remember which one it was, but one of them said the best way to get revenge on someone is to turn them into a book character. And then you just write them accordingly. You just write them the way you want. And
That makes sense.
Tom
Yeah.
Petty said
No.
a similar thing. Tom Petty said, you know, he said best revenge is to write a song about them.
Yeah,
So,
yeah. No, those that is pretty good. I would think it would be more if I did it. So this book, Narcissus Nobody, is more fictional, although there are definitely some emotional elements that are very true for me. But the circumstances of what happened are more fictional, and the characters are more combinations of people I've known mixed with in other influences. But I wrote a book previously, a whole novel, which was never published, but went through two agents and never got picked up. And that one was way more autobiographical. That was a situation where I lived some shit and then said, this would make a good novel. Or actually, I first thought I should write a memoir about it. And then the more I thought about that, I didn't want to ever talk to any of those people again. I didn't want to go back and restart. I didn't want to go back to the place where it happened. I didn't want to do the research necessary to make it factual. So I did make sort of a thinly veiled memoir as a novel. And there was some feeling of justice in people that had wronged me, portraying them in an unflattering light. But I also was careful to make there be enough degrees of difference so that they wouldn't, because you do hear horror stories. But I think it was more for myself. It was revenge, and not in the sense of it hurts them, because they probably won't even know. Nobody's ever gonna read my work. Like, people aren't out there looking for obscure literary fiction to read by like they're not gonna really discover it unless they're Googling me or something, probably. But it felt good in myself. So not exactly revenge, but catharsis,
yeah,
getting out
and
your hatred towards the
that's one of the words I
person.
was going to say. And
Yeah.
I also found that in writing and some of the things that I've written that are unpublished, yeah, it kind of helps you almost get through bullshit. In some ways, you're reliving it,
But
but
you're putting it in, you're
you're.
reviewing it in order to put it in perspective and make it something that you can learn from and something you can find the positive in and find the beauty in, find some kind of meaning in it, you know?
Absolutely. I'm talking with author Gina Yates, whose new book, Narcissus Nobody, is out on Three Rooms Press. Actually, it came out in April, which
Yes.
means it's still a new book.
Yeah, it's still pretty new.
And
April 13th is when it came out. That date had significance for me because back in 2000 and what was it, 12, I found myself. It started out as a normal day, and ended up by the end of the day, I was in the hospital having emergency brain surgery. I had a ruptured aneurysm and almost died, but I pulled through. And that was on April 13th too. So when they told me that the book was coming out on April 13th, that was another one of those kind of serendipitous things. Like, oh, cool. That was a special day to me. I think of it as a positive thing. I think of it kind of almost like my second birthday because I got a second chance at life.
that's terrible.
I was at that time, I hadn't really started writing this book yet, but I was in the thick of it with the other book. I'd been working on it for 10 years and trying to find an agent and hadn't found an agent yet, but it was on my mind a lot, this whole thing of querying and trying to find an agent. And would this book this book. I had all my eggs in one basket of this one fictionalized memoir, which was about a time in my life when I was dealt with a lot of addiction and mental illness issues while living on a Caribbean island. And that was what the story was. But I was really into trying to get that book published. I was all in on that. And I remember being in the hospital and worrying about if I was going to make it through this emergency brain surgery and just being like, I don't care. I don't care if that nothing ever happens with this book. It doesn't matter. I just want to, you know, I just want to go back to my simple life of like selling used clothes and, you know, playing with my dog. And I don't give a fuck about any of that. So it was really cool. It was kind of like a hard reset where I aligned my priorities to what I really care about is just the day-to-day, the little simple pleasures of life, just the joys of being alive and having the freedom, which I realize is a privilege that most people don't have. So I try not to take it for granted. It is a privilege. The fact that the thing I do for my day job, that selling vintage clothes, is something I actually love and actually enjoy. And it's making that a priority, making it a priority to do the things that actually bring me joy, as opposed to getting all hung up. And as I was starting to get worried about what if this book never, you know, what if nobody ever picks it up? And then I did all that work for 10 years for nothing, and I'll die in obscurity and no one will know who I am. You know, who cares?
An eye-opening experience like that, I mean, that's what kind of what brings sometimes perspective in and just kind of allows you to strip away all the bullshit and just see with absolute clarity, you know? Yeah.
That's why I like watching the news. A lot of people say they can't watch the news because it's too depressing, but my default setting on my TV is always on CNN. And when there's things going on like that heavy shit with that condo that just collapsed, it does make you kind of, wow. I mean, I was watching it just before we started tonight, and this person who was talking to their relative in that condo, and the relative said, oh, the building is shaking, oh shit, and then they screamed and then the phone went dead and that person was still missing. It was like, God, you know, there's always a lot to be grateful for if you stop and think about it.
Absolutely. I used to spend a lot of time in New York City and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I would go there every Saturday. And that was like, you know, as I mentioned to you the other day, that was like my playground for many years.
And how far is it from your town, Ford's?
Without traffic, about a half hour drive. Oh, okay. On the days where, on the Saturdays that I didn't go to the city, like if I stayed in New Jersey, in the morning, I would spend much of the day in Borders. And this is around 95, 96, 97, you know, and, you know, Borders eventually closed over the next decade. But, you know, as we kind of moved into the 21st century, in the middle of Borders was the self-help section, right? And as time went on, the self-help section just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, right? It's kind of like, you know, but there was always that stigma with the self-help section initially, you know, it was kind of like, it would be like psychology and self-help, kind of like, oh, this is.
You feel awkward if you're standing there looking at it, you don't want anyone to see which books you're reading for.
People who are fucked up over something. You know? And there was that, you know, it was kind of like almost like a notch just above, like, you know, the porn section in the video store.
Yeah,
like,
you
coming out of it or going into it, you know? Like, all kidding aside, the self-help thing exists on many, many levels. You know, it's not just books on, you know, how to get up the corporate ladder or, you know, people dealing with a breakup or a divorce. I mean, there's people that, you know, dealing
with... How to do Twitter for marketing your book.
Like, yeah, I mean, you know, there's people dealing with death, you know, the loss of a loved one and, you know, serious stuff like that. And people don't know how to fucking navigate through it, you know?
That's true.
But then, like, the whole self-help industry started incorporating things like religion and spirituality and Eastern mysticism. I remember finding a book on chakra therapy.
Yeah.
In the self-help section. And so it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You have your own personal fascination with self-help books.
Yes.
And your book, and correct me if I'm wrong, was pretty much conceived in the self-help section of a Borders.
Absolutely. It was. Yeah. The original aha moment where I said, I know what I'm going to write about for my next novel was in that exact location that you're talking about. It was the self-help section of Borders. And the Borders ended up closing, the Borders here in Albuquerque ended up closing, I think it was that same year. So that's how I know, that's how I keep the date straight in my mind. That's how I know that it was 2012 when I first had the idea for the book. But I've always been fascinated with self-help. I always watched Oprah and Donahue every day growing up. I'd get home from school and I'd watch Oprah and or Donahue and all the talk shows like that that came along. And my favorite episodes were the ones where they had real people dealing with issues and then they had some expert on who just had a book out about that issue and they were helping them get through it. Because I just think it's fascinating, all these people that figure something out and then they have the answer and then they are able to make $1 million out of it. When really it's not necessarily as though they haven't, they just were in the shower and randomly had this epiphany and put a catchy title on it. And then it just was right. It was the right book at the right time when a lot of people were going through that particular thing and needed help with it. But as for myself, I think I like looking for wisdom anywhere. I'm someone who gets really excited about a fortune cookie and hopes it's going to help me with whatever shit I'm going through. And I read my horoscope, even though I'm not really, you know, I'm pretty agnostic when it comes to a lot of, you know, is astrology real? Is anything like that? Are psychics real? I'm open to the possibility that there's a lot that goes on outside of our human consciousness and our perception, our limited perception. I mean, I'm open to it, but I'm pretty much a skeptic when it comes to all that stuff, astrology, tarot cards, anything. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to be looking there for insight, anywhere I can get some little tidbit that makes me go, So with self-help books, I've never really gone out and bought a self-help book for some particular thing I've been dealing with. But what I did used to like to do was just hang out in that self-help section and just
like
pick
the
up
center
books.
Of the whole, like the nucleus of the stores where all
it's
a reading. Or if there's somebody playing guitar.
I like to just hang out there and just pick up titles and go, oh, this looks interesting, and read a little bit and then put it down. And I thought it was interesting how some of them would be right next to each other, but saying the exact opposite thing. But really what it came down to, what my epiphany that happened that one particular day in the Borders was that I really know at that point, whatever I was going through in my life, whatever on a personal level, I was probably at my most cynical about the subject of intimacy, relationships, dating, all of that stuff. And I was fed up to a point where I just felt like, fuck all this. I felt like I wanted there to be a book that would say, you know what, you don't need any of all this. You don't need any of this, you're fine, go home. You can live a perfectly happy life, being totally by yourself and only focusing on you and, you know, have the occasional fling or whatever, but the occasional one night stand, the occasional friend with benefits and get what you can get, you know, that'll be fulfilling enough for you and everything will work out fine in the end and it won't be the end of the world. But all of these books, what I noticed a pattern with all of them that after a while, everyone I picked up seemed to be saying the same thing, especially, and I'm only talking right now about, because this was the particular section I was in that I was looking through when I realized this, that books that are aimed at single heterosexual women. And So I realized that that's a limited category, but those books in particular all had this underlying message. There was an underlying assumption that your end game is to find Mr. Right, no matter what, even though a lot of them would, judging from their titles and their main points and what it said on the back cover, it seemed like they were saying what you have to do is focus on you and forget about it and focus on yourself and put yourself first. But all of that was so, you have to pretend like you don't need a man in order to get one. Underneath it all, that was the message.
And this is where those ideas of the self-help guru kind of come into play with your storyline. Mm-hmm. You imagined that eventually unfolded into Narcissist Nobody.
Yeah, so I started thinking, I guess I started thinking about, you know, I was at a point where I felt like, yeah, but I don't really need, that's not my goal. I really, and there's also a message that you need to have good self-esteem in order to attract a man.
Right.
And if there's also this thing about if your relationship doesn't go well, probably it's something to do with your self-esteem that you need to work on. And I started thinking, you know, if I really had self-esteem, I wouldn't even need a relationship to begin with.
And was it like the majority of the books that were telling you this, that this, like, that, was this the consensus on self-help books that were saying that?
That yes. Every book I picked up at that time in 2012, and, it, you know, maybe it's changed since then, but the lady, when I did my reading with Bookworks, remember, she was like, oh no, it's all the same. They're all still the same. Because she's the bookstore lady. And
yeah,
there was this message that somehow I had to fix what was wrong with me in order to get some guy to officially give me that validation of that I'm relationship material. But without that, of course, it's going to be really sad because I'm going to be sad and lonely and how depressing. But I felt like, I guess I never had, my parents divorced when I was very young, or an infant, and I never really had positive married role models to look up to. It seemed like I just had like my friends' parents, and they seemed pretty miserable, and you know, so I never really had that thing of society, I feel, and it's loosening up a bit now, but society still has this thing about being half of a couple, like somehow once you're there, it's like you've made it. It's a status thing.
Yeah.
And these self-help books all had this underlying assumption that you wanted that status, even if you thought you didn't, you know, everybody wants that, of course. It's what everybody wants. And I feel like it is for a lot of people, just from even people that I know talking to, and this is, again, I'm kind of, when I started the book, I was at my most cynical. I've gotten less cynical since then. And also with all of this, I don't want to sound like I'm some kind of anti-love crusader, because I'm not. I think love is a grand thing, and it is great when people end up happily ever after and all that. But I feel like a lot of people are into it for the static, like, okay, this is going to sound kind of sexist maybe, but, and again, it's generalizing and there are exceptions. But it seems like for women, they want the status of being part of a couple because it means they've been chosen. You know, oh, look, somebody picked me out of all the women. I must be pretty special.
Yeah.
So that's why there's this thing about once a guy likes you and you like each other and you reach that love stage, he's obligated to love only you for the rest of eternity. And if he does, and if he doesn't, then he's an incomplete asshole and or you have low self-esteem. Just be that thing, these things are ephemeral and they don't last forever and people fall in and out of love and it's fine and it's nobody's fault. So anyway, and also with the status thing, I feel like a lot of time with the males, and again, I'm generalizing, but it's, and I'm only talking about heterosexual relationships. I think people on the queer spectrum have a lot fewer of these hangups, which a lot of times I find it easier to talk to them about these issues. But anyway, the men, it's the status of, okay, see, I'm one of the good guys. You know, I've made it, and like, I'm one of the good guys. I know how to settle down and be a responsible adult, responsible-able. And you know, I know I've said are also a financial thing. Somehow that's pretty dated, but it's still there a little bit. If you're married, it must mean you financially made it to a certain level or something like that. And these just seem like silly reasons to be your guiding force in life, to be your main priority in life. So that was all of my cynical thoughts that led to me deciding to write a novel about a self-help author who starts off saying all those cliche things, like all the books in the self-help section that I found, but then has a moment of clarity where he realizes he doesn't believe in any of that. He did that and he made a lot of money. And then he starts writing this book that I would write if I were a self-help author, which would be more just saying, don't worry about it. It's no big deal. It'll sort itself out and you're fine. Well, the book says more than that.
On the subject of weddings and marriage, there's a part in the book where two of the characters are talking about weddings. And one of them is comparing it to watching a hot dog eating contest, the way the people sit there and go to a wedding. Wide-eyed enthusiasm, focused on how people write their own vows, and nobody needs to sit there and hear all get them, you know, who's going to be perfect doormats for each other for the rest of their lives. Yeah. And I'm reading this, and I'm saying to myself, you know, yeah, at least until the first person cheats.
Yeah,
or some shit like that. You know, but most of the weddings I've gone to in my life ended in divorce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, look, I'm 50. I've been to I don't know how many weddings I've been to.
Yeah.
Oh my God! But I mean, most of them. The only two marriages that I know that are still together, of people that got married, are my parents.
Yeah, well, that's cool. And good for them.
Well, actually, no, because they were married before I was born, actually. But no, they don't count. I'm talking about the weddings that I've gone to. So right. My cousin's wedding and my aunt and uncle's wedding. So yeah, two weddings. Every last one of them ended in divorce. Some of them are on their second and third marriage.
Yeah.
They just don't learn.
I went to a wedding once a few years ago where the people wrote their own vows and they were kind of non-traditional in a lot of ways that the couple were. And when they got to the part about till death do us part, I noticed that their particular way that they worded it was like, as long as our love shall last. And I'm sitting there going,
that could be 2 weeks.
Me? I took the fucking day off. I got a new dress and I bought you a gift. I mean, also, what's that shit about? We got to buy them new dishes. I mean, like, okay, that's great that you decided you're only going to have sex with this one person for the rest of eternity. That's awesome. But why do I have to buy you dishes and a coffee maker? I mean, were you eating off the floor before? Were you like...
Because in 2 months, they're going to be fighting over who gets to keep that coffee maker.
Yeah, that's right.
You know? And it's going to be bullshit like that. So the dishes, who keeps the dishes and who keeps the dishes? You know? That's why you got to write your names in all of your books and all your albums, man. Because nobody get my albums.
Yeah.
Nobody's getting my books and nobody's getting my albums.
Yeah.
That was a Woody Allen thing. That was from Annie Hall, where he's like, writes his name. She writes her name in all of the, Diane Keaton writes her name in all of the books. So yeah, you wrote your name in all these books because you knew this day was coming. You
know? Oh, that's funny. I knew someone too, like that where when they split up, it was after many, many years, but the guy went on this trip about, okay, we're dividing everything right down the middle. It's just so depressing when it gets down to like, you know, material things and stuff like that. But really, I think marriage essentially, I mean, it is a contract. It should be looked at more like a business contract. I read, so I collect vintage magazines and stuff like that because I'm really into that, you know, reading perspectives from back in the 70s and stuff. And there was one, I think it was a Life magazine recently. And it was right in the height of the first feminism wave. And this 70s couple, the wife made an actual contract for their marriage. And it was like a business contract. And it had really specific things laid out about who does the dishes and all that shit. And who takes out the trash and who, things to do with the children. It was very specific. And a lot of the readers of this magazine, I think that the issue that I was reading was after the original article, and I was reading the letters where people were like, oh, that's so, that turns it into this cold, you know, business thing, and it's supposed to be all about love or whatever. But I think that's good. I mean, really, the marriage part is more of a contract. You're making someone sign a contract. So you should be specific about what your expectations are so that you don't get disappointed, right?
You would hope people talk about these expectations before they sign that contract, you know, and you got this.
I know, you would think they would, but a lot of them sadly don't. And I have my little vintage shop, and people occasionally, it happens about once or twice a year that people will come in for, and they'll get their wedding dress. And it's the funky young people who aren't going the traditional route. Because I don't sell actual wedding dresses. But so the weddings that I end up dealing with are people who are doing a spontaneous courthouse affair or a little backyard thing where they just, those I like. Those I'm like, oh, bless your hearts. I think it's sweet. It's like, oh, it's cool that they're young and they're so excited and they're going to spend their lives together and stuff. And you know, then I find it kind of touching, but the affairs where it's a big or lavish ordeal, it seems like it's a lot of it is about showing off to me. Look how many friends I have. Look how much money I have. I booked this expensive place. And
it's a status thing in some ways. Yeah. My dad used to say, show me who your friends are and I'll tell you who you are, or tell me who you hang out with. A lot of my friends are still single. No, mm-hmm. we're none of us got married. None of us, we all stayed, we all managed. I mean, myself, I've been through a series of shitty relationships. But I never got married. I don't have any kids. I have a 7-year-old nephew. He's my kid, you know? And he said,
yeah, that's cool. I'm
never gonna get, you know, and that's fine. And my brother, who's married with a kid and all his friends, I mean, he watched all his friends get married. And so I have a friend who, it's like a circle of three girls, right? And one of them is getting married, the other just got engaged, and now the third one is like freaking out. Now she's starting to panic. Yeah. You know, she's starting to panic because she doesn't even have a boyfriend. You know?
Oh, so
like, I mean, these are girls in their late 20s, you know, so it's like a big thing for them, you know. It's kind of So it's kind of like, oh, they kind of like watch each other, and like their insecurities are kind of based on what
the other. Yeah, it's a competition. It's a different kind of rat race.
Exactly.
When you were talking about how am I not like Hope, that one major way, I actually was married for a large chunk of time in the 90s. And believe it or not, I know it sounds weird after the way I've been talking, but believe it or not, I even had a different last name for 8 years, which to me is like, I think about that. I can't believe I did that. The situation was, I got married really young. I was only 20. I was a student in Canada, and I liked Vancouver, Canada. I went there after high school because I went there for college, and I wanted to have an adventure and be in a foreign place, but I wasn't quite intrepid enough to go to a real foreign country. And it seemed exotic and cool. And I met this Canadian guy, and around the time my dad died, and then I no longer had a way to pay for school. And I didn't know what I was doing in college either. Like, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. So I didn't have what it takes to put myself through school or anything like that. So I ended up dropping out of school, and I had this relationship, and he was like, hey, let's get married. And then that way you could stay here, because I wouldn't have a student visa. I was there on a student visa. So when I dropped out of school, I would have had to go back, and I really loved Vancouver at that point. I had all my friends there and everything. But I had always been someone, even in high school, who would argue against the idea of marriage, who would say, well, if you love someone, why do you have to make them sign a contract saying they'll love you forever, that kind of ruins it. You know, like, why would you encourage them to take you for granted? I had all these arguments. I was the outspoken anti-marriage person. But at that point, I mean, it was kind of like, well, I mean, it seemed like, well, this is different. We actually need this piece of paper that I'm always like, why do you need a piece of paper to prove? But in our case, the piece of paper would help. And it seemed like, well, you know, he made it seem like it would be an adventure. It would be fun. And we had one of those spontaneous courthouse weddings and stuff like that. So, I mean, it was kind of cool, except I did immediately start to feel way older than I was. I immediately felt like this neutered adult, like going, and I immediately felt, so, you know, there's a feeling of, oh, okay, well, this is it. And it was, I mean, I shouldn't say that, because, well, one of the things I wanted to say when I said, when I started out by saying one way I'm different from Hope is I actually was married. And it wasn't an entirely awful experience. I wouldn't have stayed married for 8 years if it was all awful. There were times when I thought it was great. I do know the joy of having someone where you're together 24/7 and are still having your little inside jokes and you feel cozy. You feel it's not boring. You still manage to not get sick of each other. Then that stuff was all great. The person I was married to, though, was kind of awful. I mean, but we still had a great time. I think I started to say this a little bit in our pre-taping. he was a kind of a sociopathic narcissist of nearly Donald Trump level proportions. But he was fun, and we had a lot of laughs. And I definitely remember having moments where I think he and I were watching Oprah one time. We were like, God, our relationship is so great and everyone else's relationship sucks. So there's that. And I really felt that. I really felt that because I thought, well, we've got it all figured out. And there is a beautiful thing where you're with someone and you feel like, oh, we figured it out. You know, we are really going to make it. And that's what I think is touching when I see young people, like the young people who come to my store to get their wedding dress. And I'm like, it's just really sweet. They really think they got it all figured out and they're gonna make it work and they're gonna last forever. It's great. I mean, love is grand. I don't want to sound like I'm this Debbie Downer about the whole subject, because I'm not.
They haven't been through their bullshit yet. They're young, yeah. You know, for lack of a better word, naive. And that's okay. You know, it reminds me of the very last episode of The Wonder Years. What was the girl in The Wonder Years?
Winnie Cooper?
Winnie. Yeah. And Kevin and Winnie are in this situation where their relationship is kind of tumultuous and they're promising they're going to stay together forever. And he says, quote unquote, it was the kind of promise that can only come from the hearts of the very young.
Oh, you know?
And
that's great. That is brilliant.
Yeah. And that's more profound than any Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan or Neil Young or Tom Waits line I've ever heard.
No, it's brilliant. I love it. It gave me goosebumps just now. Yeah. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a line that comes into my head a lot for a lot of different reasons.
I love it. Before I even got married, I had another relationship in high school where I pretty much figured I'd found the one and all that shit. And thought, you know, and I probably promised that guy that before I went off to Canada to have my own adventure. And I feel a little bad about that, but oh well.
I ran into a girl I went to high school with in a Wegmans. Do you have Wegmans over there in New Mexico?
Wegmans? No, what is it?
Kroger's or Whole Foods. It's like a
place. Okay.
Yeah, it's like that type of a place. So I ran into her, and this girl used to cut my hair back in the 90s. And I hadn't seen her for, you know, years, for a long time. And then at some point, I guess I got on Facebook and started reconnecting slowly with people I hadn't seen in years.
Yeah.
And this one, I actually ran into in person. hey, what's up? How you doing? All that stuff. You know, and she said, oh, you know, I just got divorced. I said, cool, congratulations. You know, and like she looked at me like she was just like, thanks, you know, like, and it's so she's like, oh my God. I'm like, what? She's like, you're the first person that's ever said that to me. Like, everybody is like so sad and they're trying to like pretend that it's such a horrible thing.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah.
So I'm like, congratulations, you know, that's awesome. Because
that when people is great.
Like, oh, I just got married. My first fucking reaction is my condolences.
Oh.
Sorry. You know, I'm not going to tell them that. But it's like, you poor bastard, you.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But
the whole self-help industry putting out all that stuff. And you said you were, you know, you had that moment in 2012 where you decided that all of this stuff was going to be kind of channeled through a self-help guru that you were kind of creating for your book. You would think that leading up to that year and the previous decade where the divorce rate was pushing 60%, that people would slow down, you know? I mean, our parents' generation.
People are so arrogant.
Yeah. Now, you know, I mean, like our parents are baby boomers, right? You and me, we're Generation X, right? So our parents. So
my dad was older. My dad was 20 years older than my mom. So my mom's a baby boomer. My dad's something else. He would be.
World War II generation.
Alive now, yeah.
What do they call that generation? The generation between the baby boomers. Is there a?
Generation before the baby boomers. I don't know. I don't know what that's called.
When Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation, which is in reference to the World War II generation, but your dad.
Yeah. So my dad fought in World War II. So he's that generation.
Yeah. Your dad was born in the 20s, right? Because he was
26. Yeah.
And for our listeners, because I don't think we've mentioned your dad yet. Gina is the youngest daughter of author Richard Yates, right?
Yes.
Most noted for Revolutionary Road.
Yes. Which was a movie in 2008 with Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. If people aren't familiar with the book, they might remember seeing something about the movie and how it was those two reuniting for something that was not at all like Titanic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to throw that in there for any listeners who may be thinking like, how the hell did he know when her dad was born?
Oh yeah, right.
Hey, who is this girl? You know, so who are you? Really? Who are you working for? Getting into the book a little bit, the Nathan character, the whole thing about, I was really seeing almost flashbacks of past relationships that I had with, I mean, just Nathan.
Were you Nate?
Well, I mean, like I started to say this when we were talking the other day. I was wrong on the Nathan character. I was predicting in the beginning, I was predicting that, you know, he was going to be the first in a series of guys who disappear and you never hear from again. And I didn't really expect to be reading about Nathan past the first chapter.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, like, look, I mean, he seemed like a dick at first.
Yeah.
You know, and like the use of, without giving spoilers away or anything, but the use of words like apparently. Like everything is apparently, like he has no control over the situation. Like, oh, apparently I'm moving next month.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Apparently I'm going out with some friends on Friday night.
Yeah, apparently I'm going out with some friends.
I won't be able to hang out.
You know, apparently there's this customer who has a crush on me and apparently I'm going out. You know, apparently I'm going to go have a date with her tonight.
Yeah.
So you could almost pretty much sense that maybe he already has his next relationship set up already, maybe. Yeah. And he's trying to make this seamless transition from one girl to the next. You know, I don't know if that's accurate or if that's just my reading or if maybe I just have more trust issues than you do.
No, well, that's certainly what's going through Hope's mind at the time. Although she is in some ways cooler than I would be in that situation. And she manages to not lose it. And not get all paranoid and shit. And then because of that, because she doesn't get too raspy and everything, she's able to sort of stifle her desperation. And then because of that, he stays in her life longer. I'm that way too. I have stayed in touch with exes, not in a way like we're going to hang out or anything, but I don't have any hard feelings. I feel like once you love someone, they're kind of always part of you. I have two things I want to make sure that two little anecdotes that I thought of while you were just talking that I want to make sure I get out. I loved your story of running into that girl and she said you are divorced and you said that's great. And she was like, oh, thank you. And what it reminded me of is about 10 years ago, I had a lot of mental health, serious mental health issues from about age mid-20s to mid-30s. It was a bipolar disorder, bipolar one with psychotic features. So some heavy, a couple of hospitalizations, and then there was some addiction stuff mixed in. But for the past, I've been very stable and not even on any psychiatric meds, and I don't do any recreational drugs or anything like that anymore for probably 15 or so years now. And anyway, but they still like to check in on you. The medical community likes to make sure you're okay. So I went to see a psychiatrist about 10 years ago, and I'd never seen, it was only one visit, and I'd never been to him. But he just wanted to check in and make sure I wasn't going to slip into anything, because they have to do that. And so he just asked me about how things were going and everything. And he said, well, you know, what about like, you know, romance or relationships or anything? And I mentioned to him that, well, I've been single for however long it had been at that point, pretty much since my divorce, because since my divorce, anything I had wasn't a real relationship. It was like hope, just a lot of frustrating bullshit. But a lot, lots of dry spell, lots of period, lots of time where there was no one. So I said to him, oh, well, I pretty much haven't had a relationship for however long. It was a long time. Let's see. So it was 10 years. It would have been like 10 years or something. And anyway, this psychiatrist, he goes, oh, really? Wow, that's impressive. How'd you manage to avoid that? And I mean, his demeanor and everything was really genuinely happy for me, the way you sounded telling your friend, oh, congratulations. It was really cool. It made me feel great. And I was like, oh, yeah, and it was so great. I mean, he was just some psychiatrist, but it was like, yeah, it was very validating and really cool. So anyway, that was one thing.
What's the other one?
The other one was how you were talking about how people are secretly planning their escape from their marriage.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So I love vintage. I have a vintage store. I love vintage magazines. I love vintage postcards, ephemera, any kind of letters or old comics or anything like that. I'm always in the flea market digging for stuff like that. And a while ago, I started noticing, well, not a while ago, like for a long time, I've noticed that in the 50s, when everything was very Beaver Cleaver and the marriage and family was an expected thing and everybody was supposed to be all wholesome. At the same time, all the comedy, you know, if you think about shows like The Honeymooners, if you think about the comedy that was in magazines and on postcards that people were really laughing about and thought was funny, it was about how people were so fucking miserable in their marriages. And
so true.
A lot of it was about how, you know, wanting to have an affair with a secretary and all that stuff. And it's funny because, you know, the comedy, what makes something funny is that it has an element of truth in it. Anyway, I went in a internet rabbit hole of looking at comedians and talking about marriage and stuff like that. And I found a clip of Jimmy Stewart telling this joke. Jimmy Stewart was on some late night talk show. And the talk show host, I forget who it was, but they said, okay, what's the funniest joke you've ever heard? And he didn't have to think about it for long. He had it ready. He had it right there in the holster. And he was like, okay, here it is. I got it. And you know, you think of Jimmy Stewart, you like, you can picture him, like he's pretty wholesome. I love him. But anyway, he's telling this joke, and the joke is, I hope I don't butcher it, but I'll do my best to get through it. I might have to take a couple of takes. But all right. So nice little married couple and a wholesome scene. And this nice married couple are having breakfast, and he's reading the paper, and you know, they're having their eggs and sausages and whatnot. And the wife just out of the blue says, "If, honey, you know, I was just wondering, if I died, would you remarry?" And the husband is just looks at her all shocked. Oh my God, where is this coming from? We're having a nice breakfast. How could you bring up such a horrible thought? I will not answer that. I don't want you to think like that. You're going to be around for a long time. Don't even bother me with this. Okay, so then the next day, she can't quite let it go. He doesn't quite ease her mind. So the next day at breakfast, she brings it up again. But honey, no, really, would you remarry? And he's the same reaction. Oh my God, I'm not gonna, how could you? And then finally wears him down enough to where he's okay, I would remarry, yes. You know, because I like being married and whatever. She's okay, well, would you live in the same house? And he again, oh, what are you doing? No, okay, I would live in the same house. And maybe another day goes by where she just can't seem to let this thing go. And he's trying to move past it. And so the next day he said, well, but now, again, if I died, would you, and you were living in this house, would you still keep our same bed? The husband said, okay, yes, I would keep the same bed. I mean, if it was still in good shape and everything. And so the wife says, but you wouldn't let her use my golf clubs. And the husband says, no, I would not let her use your golf clubs. Absolutely not. She's left-handed. That was the punchline.
What's the comedian's name? Did you say Jimmy what?
Jimmy Stewart.
I initially thought you said Jimmy Stewart, like the guy from...
It's a Wonderful Life. That's who it was.
It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart.
Did you even get the joke? Because I said it, and I said the punchline, it was like crickets. And I'm like, oh shit, I just totally bombed.
I fucking bombed. I bombed because, wait, help me get it. What am I missing? All right, wait, let me think about it. Your golf club, she's left-handed. Oh, fuck, so she, okay, that's so stupid of me.
You get it now?
Yes, I get it.
Okay, good.
That's embarrassing, see?
No, it's fine. You know, I would understand if you were listening to me and watching me, where is he going with this?
I do get it.
It was a long story. Like, where is this? Is this ever going to end? Am I going to edit this out or not?
There's a similar joke about, like, I'll edit this out because it's like, you know, now I'm going off on a tangent. But all right, like,
are you going to edit out my joke too?
Huh? What?
I said, are you going to edit out my joke too? I thought it was good, except when you didn't laugh. What?
You want me to edit it out? I'll put it in there. I'll make myself look like a fool. It's all right.
Just edit in, pretend like, I mean, make a tape of yourself, or a tape, listen to me. Like, make a tape of yourself laughing and put that in. Yeah, insert the laugh track where appropriate. Okay, what's your joke?
I don't remember the joke. Here's the gist of the joke, right? So these guys are playing golf, and there's three of them, and one guy's like, oh, look on the bright side. Always saying, look on the bright side. You know, look on the bright side. Look on the bright side. They hate him because he always says, look on the bright side. It could always be worse. They're tired of this guy saying it could always be worse. So they decide they're gonna fuck with him. They're going to totally play a joke on him. So the guy goes, I don't even remember what their names were, Joe and Steve, right? And Carl is missing, all right? Carl is
Carl is the guy who always says it can always be worse?
No.
Okay, no. Sorry.
So Carl is missing, all right? So Joe and Steve are on the golf course, and they're like, well, where's Carl? He's like, oh, you didn't hear? He's like, what? He's like, Carl is dead. He's like, what happened? You're kidding, what happened? He said, like, as you can tell, I don't know this joke, so I'm just making it up.
Yeah. I'm with you so far.
So he goes, well, he went home Thursday night and he caught his wife fucking another guy. So he took the gun and he killed both of them and he killed himself.
Oh, shit.
Oh my, isn't that horrible? He goes, could be worse. I said, what do you mean it could be worse? What the fuck is wrong with you? Carl is dead. He said, well, yeah, but you said that he caught his wife fucking another guy on Thursday and then he killed. He said, yeah. He's like, well, it could have been worse because if it was Wednesday, that guy could have been me. I would have been.
And yeah. That's pretty good. Is that joke from the 50s too?
Yeah, I don't know.
That kind of sounds like it.
I don't know.
Pretty good. Just,
yeah. So anyway.
I think Jimmy Stewart would approve of that joke.
Yeah, yeah. There's a part where when you said like the way she handles it, the way Hope handles it, where she gets like kind of like really tough on him. Like there's a one part where she's like, oh, he brings up like I was just talking to a friend of mine. Right.
Yeah.
And the friend is always inevitable. Always shows up just in time to mark the end of the honeymoon. Right. There's always like, you know, two people get together. And I'm not saying this is in every relationship, but in a lot of relationships, you have like two people get together. They spend every waking minute together. It's great. The first few months, whatever it is. Right. And then suddenly out of nowhere, the girl or the guy, they start telling you in a careful roundabout way about this friend that you never knew existed.
Oh, yeah, right. But suddenly they're talking about them all the time. Like, oh, yeah, so-and-so said. Like, oh, yeah.
That's usually the first bump in the road.
Yeah.
And in many
cases, that's a red flag.
That's the end of the relationship right there. So it's like when Hope says, wow, and she notices that her voice is shaking, you know, and she said something to the effect of, like, all of her, like future plans just kind of evaporate. You know,
when he said he was talking to a friend, but it was like he was talking to
Is it out of context with the story?
No, it's fine. I'm trying to recall the exact scene you're talking about, and I think it's when
it's almost in
like the Nathan's on the phone. So Nathan is the guy who is a friend with benefits who won't admit that they're any kind of anything more than just friends, even though they're seeing, you know, together every night and everything. And he's on the phone with someone else and just some friend of his, but she doesn't know anything about who his friends are or what his life is outside of the time they're together. When he explains to the person on the phone that he's talking to a friend, and he's referring to Hope as just a friend. And that's what gets Hope all in a tailspin. I'm just a friend. I'm just nobody. I'm just a friend. It's not like, my girlfriend just walked in. You know?
You kind of see like where she kind of gets all big and bold, but it's kind of like a defense mechanism in a way where, you know, when Nate tells her that, you know, when he's apparently, quote unquote, supposed to go meet this girl, you know, and then he tells her that he doesn't go. And she kind of gets like bold, and I'm gonna read the quote, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Right? I like it because it's kind of like, I can't picture like my 21-year-old self saying this, you know, and it's kind of like, well, actually it's a female perspective, but so yeah. I'm quoting your book.
Okay.
She interrupted him, jabbing at his chest with her finger and grinning. You were spared she'd be too streetwise to fall for all your bull fuckery. Yeah. I can see why you'd be worried about that. You didn't want to risk getting dissed in front of all those coffee shop nerds. So you stayed home and jerked off instead. See, I know this stuff. I have psychic powers. Bet you didn't know that, did you? So you could almost see the psychology at work here, right? Going from that shaky voice insecurity,
yeah,
that you could barely hide.
Yeah, yeah.
It is right in your face defense mechanism, you know, and you just know it's an act. You know what I mean? It's kind of like.
It is an act, but I'll tell you from the female perspective, if this might enlighten you as to why females have behaved in a certain way in your past, there is a sense that you have to kind of be a little bit mean to guys in order to, because otherwise you have to be a little bit meaner than you feel like sometimes. Because there is this sense that they're going to freak out if you aren't a little bit prickly.
Yes, absolutely.
Then they might freak out and think you're expecting an engagement ring or some damn thing, you know. And even if you don't have that agenda at all, a lot of times because of all that stuff I was just telling you about, and I think not just the self-help industry, but society in general, and all of that underlying, whatever it is, but the assumption that we all have based on society's expectations about what women expect and what men expect, which is not really always accurate, it's just a generalization. But because of those generalizations, it causes both parties to jump to conclusions. It causes the men to be on the defensive. Oh, I don't want her to think we're any kind of like, we're gonna go have a kid or anything like that. Oh, she's getting older. She must be having that biological clock thing. And so she must think she must be expecting we're gonna get married and have a kid and everything. So I better, people get all paranoid when really, each situation is different, and if they would just relax and let the person express themselves, they would see that there's no reason to get all panicked. And yeah, so as a female, sometimes you have to be a little more of a jerk than you maybe are. So Hope has this thing going for her where she is basically a very loving person. She is very, basically very warm and compassionate. But when it comes to men, she has to be a bit of an asshole sometimes as a defense or as
if only to say, look, I'm on to you. Like I see your bullshit. Like I know when you're bullshitting me.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. You know, it's just kind of don't fuck with me. In other words, don't try to bullshit. You know, don't try to feed me any of your bullshit. You know, apparently. I know better than you think I do.
Apparently, apparently you're not as smart as you think you are.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's the way I read it. That's the way I kind of read it. And then there's just kind of like a, I don't want to say a turning point, but kind of like there's like a big turning point that kind of comes in chapter 5 or 6. And then there's kind of like a little one where, I have another quote that I pulled because I want to read this quote to get to my point, where she says, where she's kind of confronting Nathan on their relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a moment where she says, you know, the other day at work, and I'm reading you now. You know, the other day at work, someone asked me if I had a boyfriend, and I took so long to answer that they changed the subject. I mean, what was I supposed to say? Well, I'm seeing someone for 6 months, but it's not really a relationship. She took another deep breath, trying to ignore the fact that she had the phrase "eye on the prize" rapidly circling through her brain like bad sitcom music. This is like really the first time that she's kind of realizing that Nixon has gotten into her brain a little bit.
Yeah. So the phrase "eyes on the prize" is one of the little catchphrases in one of the Brooks Nixon books.
Right.
Brooks Nixon is this self-help author who is writing these very formulaic books that sell really well, in which he advises women how to pretend they don't need a man in order to bring them in reel, the hook them and reel them in, catch them and keep them. So even though she dismissed, when she read the Brooks Nixon book, she didn't actually go out and buy it. You know, she was like how I was talking about hanging out in the Borders self-help section and just kind of curious, picking up a book here and there. In her case, she got this Brooks Nixon book in a way that I often get books myself. She's at a yard sale and she loves yard sales, and she wasn't even going to buy the book, but she felt sorry for the guy running the yard sale because he didn't, you know, he was a compulsive hoarder and trying to just get rid of shit. And she was like, okay, I'll take something off your hands. She saw that and she thought it would be entertaining. A lot of times I'll pick up something. I've picked up random weird self-help and not just self-help, random weird books of all kinds, because it would be entertaining in an ironic way. And she thought she would read it and have a good chuckle about how stupid he was. But yet, even things that you are reading in an ironic way or watching in an ironic way, you know, did you ever just end up watching some show that some soap opera, say, that you just thought this will be funny because it's so pathetic and weird, but then you're really into it. So she kind of got that way with the Brooks, and I mean, she wasn't really into it, but it seeped into her subconscious to where she started taking his advice without being consciously aware of it. And one of his things was keep your eyes on the prize, be calm, act cool on the outside, but keep your eyes on the prize. Therefore, don't, you know, she's thinking about Brooks Nixon's lame advice as though it might help her, because at this point, why not just try?
Right.
But she's trying to bat that thought away. No, I'm not listening to him.
And then she ends up.
It's kind of like if you're a superstition, that you're like, you know, like we were talking about earlier, I don't actually think the number 9 is magical, but it doesn't hurt to wear this necklace now. It's not good.
Right. The big thing with Nixon in the story, Brooks Nixon, the Brooks Nixon character, which kind of reminds me of a reversed version of the Tom Cruise character in Magnolia, which, you know,
oh my God. Okay. You are genius. huge inspiration. I love that movie. I love that fucking movie. I love that movie. I love that character. I had an inspiration board with pictures of Tom Cruise, not in Magnolia, but
yeah.
I love that movie and I love that character. He's a huge inspiration. You are the cinephile and historian that you claim to be, my friend. I'm impressed. I had that. Respect the cock. Respect the cock
That's it. Yeah. Wow. See, I was wondering if, like, see, most people I say, oh, did you see this movie? No, nobody knows what the hell I'm talking about. So props to you, girl.
I'm usually that person who has no idea what people are talking about when it comes to movies, even though if you ask me what are my favorite movies, Magnolia would be one of them, but I would draw a blank. And when people start talking, going on about this movie or that movie, I often feel lost and out of it. Unlike with music, I'm a little bit better, but with movies, I don't have the patience to sit through a lot of movies and to follow the plot and everything. And but I fucking love Magnolia. So that was great. And I had on my inspiration board when I very first, actually, it might've even been that trip to Borders it wasn't, because I'm picturing it now. I can visualize it. And it was a Barnes and Noble, but it was around the same time, around 2012, when I had first decided and figured out what I was going to write for this novel. And I thought of the Brooks Nixon character, and I even had a title before I had anything else. It was Narcissist Nixon. But but I remember it was actually Barnes and Noble. I remember picking up a Dorothy Parker journal that had a quote from her on the front that was going to be for my notes for the novel. And the same visit, I picked up a postcard of Tom Cruise. It wasn't from Magnolia, but it was a postcard of Tom Cruise where he was like, I have the postcard still, I'm sure, somewhere. But he was standing on a roof kind of squatting, and it reminded me of that thing where he jumped on the couch when he was in love with what's her face on Oprah.
Oh, remember Katie when Holmes.
He jumped on the couch? Yeah. He was in love with Katie Holmes, and he was like, yeah, I'm in love, and he jumped on the couch.
Yeah.
I even thought that was cool. Even as cynical as I am, I'm like, that's awesome. That he's just like, yes, I'm in love, and he jumped on the couch. I was like, I fucking love him. He's great. I don't care that he, I mean, whatever. He's a Scientologist, and he's kind of insane. But, you know, Magnolia was fucking brilliant.
So anyway,
I bought this postcard of Tom Cruise to be on my inspiration board, because that character was such an inspiration for Brooks Nixon, even though it's totally different, because that character's target market is men trying to get laid. And Brooks Nixon's target audience is women trying to land a man for a commitment. So it is very different, but they're both funny. They're both funny because of how ridiculous they are and over the top.
Yeah. So like the thing with him is that he kind of changes his perspective over time, right? He begins kind of telling his audience, forget everything I was telling you. Maybe the answer is not in monogamy. If you still believe that, then don't worry about it so much. Just don't worry about forcing the issue, right? Love's going to find a way, right? Like the Pablo Cruz song says, you know, in most cases, you're better off alone. Happy on your own. Like, where does he start pissing off his audience? Is it just because he does that, he changes his outlook? Or is it, does he go further? Does he take it further than that, where people start taking?
Yeah, he does. So originally my idea was that he would just start saying, maybe you're better off alone. If you're an introvert, well, he doesn't say this, but my philosophy that's kind of behind it is that some people are introverts. They get their energy from being alone, and being around other people drains them. So if you're that way, maybe you don't necessarily need to have someone around you 24/7. Maybe you are better off just having occasional people in and out of your life. And originally that was the way I was going to have his character arc go, and start just saying, maybe it's okay if you just have a series of romantic entanglements that make up one big tapestry. Kind of like, you know how nowadays people are less fixated on trying to have one career that they excel at, and that's it, and they're putting together a patchwork of different little side hustles, and then that makes up one whole career. And so my original idea was that Brooks would be saying, it's okay, you can have a lots of little loves, and it'll make, and in the end, you'll be fine. But about when I was writing the novel, about two-thirds of the way through, I felt like this needs something. This needs to be, I need to raise the stakes a little. It's a little bit too, I just need to spice it up a little. So I had him go a little too far into, he writes one book where he gets into the territory of almost telling people, it's almost an instruction manual to how to have affairs, how to break up other people's marriages. So I needed something, because I knew I wanted to have him to have this spectacular downfall where everyone turns against him. And I felt like just saying you could be by yourself and that's okay wasn't quite enough. So I had him be a little bit more controversial, turn it up a notch, had him talking about how, you know, if you're into someone and they're married, that doesn't matter. You can still, you can get them to.
He starts going as far as just like almost like aiding and breaking up, telling people how to fuck up their own marriage. You know, and it's kind of like, wait a second, this guy's like,
He goes a little bit off the rails.
Yeah.
He takes things just a little too far to where people actually get upset and start to blame him when their partner read that book and it made, you know, it destroyed their situation. So yeah, I needed to raise the stakes to make it more something that would realistically cause a fall from grace that was as big as what he had to where he ended up. Although in some ways, you know, one can interpret it as that he didn't really lose it all because he stayed true to his own. He was better off because at least he was being real with who he was. It was important to me that Brooks is this character to me who was a warrior for truth, be at least truth the way he saw it. Not that there's any kind of ultimate truth, but.
Right. The whole Narcissus thing is he kind of gets the name Narcissus Nixon. And we were talking the other day on kind of the difference between the myth, the Narcissus of the myth, which I don't know if, I think Brooks Nixon actually makes the statement something to the effect of like, Narcissus never hurt anybody, or he never, you know, he was just kind of,
yeah,
he couldn't help it because all the nymphs loved him, you know, it wasn't his fault doing his thing, versus the narcissistic personality, which is not quite the same thing though, right?
No, a narcissistic personality is somebody who craves validation and praise from other people all the time. And like, I mean, the classic narcissist that everybody thinks of is Donald Trump. It doesn't even, whatever happened, even if he did something awful where he just looked like a fool, he'll find a way to spin it and turn it around and say, no, actually, I'm the stable genius and I'm the one who, you know, he'll find a way to put a spin on it to make himself look good. Because the most important thing to the narcissist at the end of the day is the way other people see them, because they need that in order to feel okay about themselves. The myth, basically, what everyone thinks of is he's looking at his reflection in the pool and he, you know, he's like so in love with himself that he ends up drowning or whatever. And all these, everyone else, male and female, were just falling all over him trying to win his affection because he was so gorgeous or whatever. He was so stunning and charming, and they all wanted him, and they were all throwing themselves at him left and right. But he didn't care. He was just basically immune to it. So bottom line is, he was in love with himself. And when you hear that phrase, in love with yourself, that sounds bad, but my take on that whole myth that like, he was in love with himself, well, that's okay. One should be in love with oneself.
Love yourself is like the very foundation of the entire self-help industry. You know, it's like the absolute primary value is self-respect.
Isn't that what you're supposed to do? I mean, for God's sake.
So it's like, love yourself doesn't necessarily mean like, oh, look at me, I'm beautiful, I'm so in love with myself. In terms of self-help, it's just based around, you know who you are, appreciate who you are, know your worth, know that you're worth something to someone else, you know, respect yourself. It all begins with self-respect and what your role is in the fucking universe, you know, and how you affect others. That's love yourself, right?
And the opposite of being in love with yourself is hating yourself, thinking you're a disgusting pile of useless, you know, garbage. And that's what depression is. And I'm saying that as someone who suffered from real severe clinical depression for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be not in love with yourself. That is not a good place to be. You don't want to be, find yourself to be repulsive and horrible.
And we're in this like mainstream society that pop culture loves to focus on people's tragedies, you know, where people's sadness, people coming apart at the seams, you know, like the bad car crash that we can't, and we're obsessed with. And it's like the whole tabloid culture, like TMZ, like all this, like happening with Britney right now, you know?
Oh, poor Britney. Britney,
you know, like they're not going to stop until she does God knows what. And whereas if somebody could, like, you know, actually generate some sort of sympathy for the kinds of things that drive Brooks Nixon, to drive those changes in him. You know what I mean? It's like, can you imagine?
It's like, how dare you be so in love with yourself, and how dare you be so self-obsessed and so self-absorbed?
Yeah.
We all need to be a little more self-absorbed, I would think, and a little less absorbed.
I mean, I'm just putting that possibility out there. You know what I mean? It's kind of like trying to think of, like, in terms of like the mainstream pop culture that kind of crucified Brooks Nixon. It reminded me of so many artists too, that, you know, just not as disingenuous as Nixon was in the beginning, when he was, you know, you get their attention, you sell them some bullshit, you know, you tell them what you think they want to hear. But, you know, there, I mean, like artists, the best artists are the ones who piss off their audience. You go all the way back to Stravinsky. When he put out The Rite of Spring in 1907, he pissed off his audience. He horrified tonal music. Bob Dylan pissed off his audience when he played rock music at a folk festival. I'm sure Garth
Brooks. You have to be willing to take that risk and trust that it's going to work out, and the right people will appreciate it. And great artists aren't afraid to piss off their audience.
No. I was going to ask you a bunch of questions about yourself and about your life and stuff. I seriously answered all of them already, just on your own.
Yeah, that's good. It just happened.
The course of our conversation, you brought this up, or you mentioned this, or you mentioned that. And it was like this series of questions that I wanted to talk about after we talked about the book. So, for our listeners, I'm going to pick this up after the edit. So for our listeners, the book is Narcissus Nobody. It's out on Three Rooms Press. Sorry, I didn't even talk. Try that again. Take two. It's out on Three Rooms Press, and the author is Gina Yates. So, hey, Wasted Grave. We didn't talk about Wasted Grave. We know that Wasted Grave is based on The Cure. I asked you that a few months ago, the first time I talked to you. And I was like, I had a strange feeling it was The Cure, but I wasn't quite sure. Were they your favorite band growing up? Did they have the same lyrical thing that you kind of went through life with, quoting them and kind of associating?
Absolutely. So my musical development was sometime around puberty. We moved around a lot growing up. So I was always, every time we moved, having to reinvent myself and figure out who I was. And I guess it was sometime around puberty, I started to notice that the kids who wore a lot of eyeliner and wore black and had asymmetrical haircuts were kind of my tribe. And I figured that out. And I discovered The Cure on my own. It wasn't like my friends were into it, so I got into it. I used to watch a thing that we didn't have cable, so we didn't have MTV, but there was a show that was the alternative music videos. Was
120 minutes?
Yeah, it was like 120 minutes, except it wasn't, I didn't have MTV, we didn't have cable, so it was on the cable access show, and it was the hosts were local. They were just these funky people that were hosted this video show, and it was all that kind of music. And so the first album that I discovered was Head on a Door, and I got really into it on my own. And also at the same time, the kids I gravitated towards were of that tribe. And so, that was the band that growing up that I listened to when I was all in my feels, and being a kid, being in my room, being in my solitude. What was beautiful about their music to me was the way you look at Robert Smith. He's kind of looks like he's uncomfortable in his own skin, and he's kind of squirmy, and it is like, but it's somehow beautiful, and the lyrics don't make any sense and are creepy and weird and makes you feel like there's, you know, worms crawling on you, but it's all, and that's how you feel as a teenager. That's how you feel as a teenager. So you're like, oh, this music, like they get me. So yeah, so I when I wrote the character of the rock band Wasted Grave, which is the fictional rock band that is Hope's favorite band all throughout the book, or it's her favorite band when she's young, and then she has a special attachment to it throughout the book as she gets old, as it is with bands. Like you have Kiss, they're like it's your first band that you're really passionate about, and it's maybe throughout your life you're not always listening to their albums constantly, but it has a special place in your heart because it was the first thing that got you really excited about music.
Right.
And that's how The Cure was for me, and that's what I based this band Wasted Grave on. And when I was writing their imaginary songs, I was thinking about imaginary songs by The Cure. So it was a huge influence. And
that's cool. That's cool.
That's good. So we got to cover that subject that you would have later been like, oh, wait, we forgot to talk about that. That's good.
No, I wanted to get back to there was no way I was going to not mention Wasted Grave. I mean, we're a music podcast, so I have to put the music part in here, you know? And it's just like, I mean, when you were doing that whole thing in the 80s of, you know, The Cure and discovering Head on the Door and your identity crisis. I mean, look, my equivalent to that was my metal years.
Yeah.
You know, being in high school, you had to look a certain way. You know, when metal came, and I don't know if this is true for the music that you listen to. Maybe it is. There was almost a pressure and almost like there was like a uniform. You had to look a certain way. You had to act a certain way. You used certain code. You know, there were certain words that you used. You know, there was like a language that you spoke, you know. You weren't.
Absolutely. And I remember this. I liked this discussion when it came up in one of your other episodes. You were talking about that with regard to metalheads, and it was the same for my whole scene. And it made me think of the year I graduated high school and I moved to Vancouver, and I was in college. And there was this one moment when I got really into that song by George Michael, Freedom 90.
Yeah.
And I was like, this song is fucking great. And I don't care. And I bought the single. And it was the first time in my life where I really felt like this song is great. And I'm not saying that in an ironic way. You know, like that is actually kind of, I don't hate it. It was like, no, this song fucking is great. And I don't care. I'm going to rock out to it. And in it's something that whole thing, that whole phenomenon happens a lot in my day job with the vintage shop, because I deal in clothes that are kind of ironically awesome. They're hideous because they're so 80s or whatever, but yet kids are like, you know, and like my customers come in and they walk around and they go, you know what, I actually don't hate this. You know, or they say, you know what, this is the most hideous thing I've ever seen, and yet I somehow love it. What is that? And I'm constantly sitting there to myself thinking, just say you love it, for fuck's sake. Just don't get over all that.
I find so many cool things in thrift stores. In the village, in the village. But
yeah.
Oh my God, I would probably shop at your store.
Yeah, I know, you would. And you would unironically love the stuff, I hope.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
That's another thing. Every time I say Hope, I feel like I'm making a play on words because that's the main character from the novel's name.
Yeah. Is there any, like, what's the hardest thing about it, though? Is there anything you hate about writing?
Well, I'll give you my favorite Dorothy Parker quote, which is, I hate writing, I love having written. And I think pretty much any writer can identify with that. you know, and once you've had the satisfaction of something, if you wrote something and it worked out, then you know what that feels like, and that feels great. And you have to hold that in your mind as, you know, as the eyes on the prize, the thing that you're striving for. But a lot of writing is really agonizing. It really is. I mean, you just have the whole days where you spend, you feel like you've been struggling for hours and you haven't made any progress. Everything you turned out was garbage. And it can be really painful to feel like you're just spinning your wheels and not getting anywhere. It's not fun. A lot of it is not fun, and it's not for the faint at heart. It's for people who you have to really, really, really be sure that what you want is that ultimate feeling of completion. You know, you have to be really sure that you have this story in you and you're going to get it out. You have to have that certain, there's a level of drive that is necessary. Writing, a lot of it isn't fun, and you just have to have that determination to sweat through the really hard part.
The torture for me is like, and I've tried it, and the only reason I was able to get through this book that's coming up is because I knew the characters already. I know who's who. Yeah. Everybody is fictionalized, but they're real people. All I had to do was change the names. But character development, it's like, I'm editing my book now, like, and I've been editing for like the past 4 months, and I've got another 2 months of it because I've gone after revision, and I sent it to my designer in, I guess, at the end of August, but I can't.
I like editing the best, because at that point, you're done with the hard part, to me.
See, I just want to get this done.
Editing is the most fun part, because you've already done the work of, the hardest part for me is, I guess, the hardest part for me is making it into a story that will keep people interested, to where instead of just, with my first novel, which was the fictionalized memoir that I talked about, I hired a professional editor, and one of her early comments, and this was hard to hear, but it did turn out to be helpful, but one of her early comments was, this isn't a story at all. It's just a series of incidents.
Vignettes. And
a lot of the time when I write, I feel like my writing is just a series of incidents. And
so
looking
what?
At the criticism that I get, criticism that I get from potential agents, potential publishers, that whole thing is the biggest challenge for me, making it into a story arc that has enough there to keep people interested in turning pages, and to make it not just seem like I'm just rambling on, and you know.
So, I mean, I dare ask, what's next for Gina Yates? Do you have any one project that you're working on at the moment, or is it you just kind of?
I don't have a novel in progress, although I have some ideas kicking around, but after I finished this novel, I started getting into short stories more than I'd ever been before in my life. And I got my first handful of short stories published in low-key internet literary magazines and things like that. And I guess I'm working on a short story collection. I guess I probably have about 10 short stories that are not awful that I would like to get. And I probably need about 20 because they're kind of short. They're pretty short, but short stories are my jam right now. I'm really into them. And
yeah,
I think they're a great form. I love how they're so self-contained and they're just a little slice of life. And the recent piece I've been working on is one short story that is longer than my other short stories that has been taking me about 3 years. That has been on my mind, put it away, and then I come back to it.
Wow.
That is like, I can't believe that it's taking so long, and it's only a short story. So I hope I'll have an announcement on Twitter that I found a home and it's in some magazine. or something.
You know that there's a cliche that we're our own worst critics, right?
Yeah.
Is it taking that long because you feel it's not ready, or the story is just not done, or you're just not like, this is not done, like this is not ready, it's not up to my standards, or it's not up to, like, do you
taking that long to organize it into something that even looks like a story?
Okay, I got you.
Even has a beginning and an end and doesn't seem like a bunch of tangents that
something cohesive nowhere. Yeah. Something cohesive. Yeah.
It's not cohesive. It's just now starting to feel like, okay, I can see the shape of it.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's satisfying. That's a good feeling.
No, it is. It is. It's like the only way I can relate it to is because what I do is where you have all this research and you have all, you know, you have all your research, you have all your interviews done. You have all your pieces in front of you, and now you got to start putting it together into some sort of linear story. Yeah. You know, you got to tell your story with the pieces you have. And you know, it's fun though. It is
fun. I mean, and then the thing that keeps you going is that, you know, those individual pieces, you feel excited about those individual pieces.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, you feel like, I know there's something great in here underlying it all. And I just have to, it's also hard when you're editing to know when you're done. Like,
yeah, after, you have to know when you're done.
After all the things with my publisher, I still have things. The book is out now, and I still have things.
You're still writing it. You're writing it in your head.
Yeah, I'm still like, I wish I had fixed that one little small part.
Well, in my book, I have Andrew Jackson's inauguration as 1929 instead of 1829. So like one little of the key. And I'm like, how many revisions? And two or three people didn't catch that in revisions.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got to live with that. So that's my, you know, I mean, I can pull the book.
Everyone probably has things like that. Yeah.
But you know what? It is what it is. I'm already, like I said, I want to get the second one out so I can start the third one. And I hate it. I just want to fast forward the next 3 months. But is there anything that you want to plug, or is there anywhere, do you have like a website or anything where if people want to find out about you or buy your book or anything that you want to plug?
Well, I have a website, but like many artists, and I think this is true for writers, musicians, like I have a website that I'm not very great at maintaining, but it does have a way you can reach out to me, and I try to keep it updated. It's GinaYates.net. If you follow me on Twitter, I'm pretty active on there. I recently picked up a writing book in a thrift shop, and I befriended the author. It was so cool. It was from 2007, but I liked it so much, I befriended the author on Twitter. And one of her things was, think of your writing like a friend that it's a relationship you've had for a long time, and you don't want to really let the relationship fizzle. So you've got to nurture it. If you have a friend and they keep making plans with you and then not showing up, like, you're not going to hang around waiting around for them forever. So put yourself in the shoes of your writing. They're not going to wait around for you to show up. Like, they're going to.
Yeah.
So that was an eye opener for me, the way she put it. And I've started thinking of it that way, to nurture the relationship with the writing, because you're a writer. That's what you do. It's in the blood.
Yep, absolutely. But this was one of the mega mosaic conversations that I had. this one was good.
Oh, that's good. I'm so happy, and thank you for being such a warm and welcoming.
It's gonna be a mindfuck to edit.
No, it was great. I love it. And when you were like, when you were saying, you know, I don't have a lot of ton of followers or whatever, that makes it so much easier. I mean, not just easier, more fun for me. Like, seriously, if this was the NPR or something, I would have just been so stifled, afraid of what to say, and I wouldn't have said anything good. I just would have been shitting bricks the whole time, and
The more I think about it, the more I hate listening to myself. When I listen, and I have to do it all the time because I have to edit. And I listen to myself, and my three biggest things that I cannot stand about it, listening to myself, is man, yeah. And you know.
Oh, I didn't notice any of that.
No, but you notice it because you're listening to yourself.
Exactly. And my things are, I giggle when things aren't funny. I have this laugh that just, I'm not even... See, I just did it.
It's a nervous laugh. And I do it too, because it kind of fills in this empty space where you're not quite sure what you just said, and you're not quite sure of how the person is going to take it. So you kind of fill in that empty space, right? I do it too.
Yeah.
It's kind of, that's the way I don't know if that's true, but that's the way I interpret it, is when I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
It's like,
if the more you think about it and the more you're conscious of it and trying not to do it, it just makes it worse. So you have to just forget about it. Yeah, it's probably the same with your and you know and stuff like that. But yeah. if you watch professionals, if you watch CNN, you'll know that you can observe that people like Anderson Cooper, they all have their tics like that.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel a little better. And another thing about mine is I feel like I have a nervous voice. So I'm really bad at when I have to lie to a cop when I got a speeding ticket and make up some extenuating circumstances or something. It's like so obvious that I'm full of shit because I got a parking ticket the other day and someone said, you just call them and tell them you went into the shop to get change for the meter and they'll let you off the hook. But I couldn't do it because I knew I would get that nervous thing in my voice. I'd probably be giggling too much. And then the whole thing, the jig would be up.
Well, I think your book is great. I think you're a great writer. And I think we just had a great fucking episode.
That was excellent. Thank you. And let me know how I can be of service in the editing process.
Oh, so I'm going to send you a whole file so you can edit it.
What? Yeah, really.
Pouring on me, man.